Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another great episode we have here at Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb, and I am so happy that you guys have all decided to join us today. Over very close now to 40,000 listeners, we're pushing our way up, and we want to thank everybody who continues to keep listening wherever you are. We love you. So today we have a two-hour packed show, four great authors. We're going to have Alan Jacobson up first, then we're going to have Rick Reed, Bruce Holbert, and then we're going to finish it off. We're going to have Eric Van Lustbader on. So we have an action-packed, jam-packed show. It's good to be back after 3 weeks off. Happy Father's Day to everyone out there tomorrow, because 2 hours of Suspense Radio starts right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're going to like it. I think you're going to feel you belong.
Again, everybody, we are back here with another great episode of Suspense Radio, and I want to go ahead, our good friend Alan Jacobson, who you guys might remember many times, author of the Karen Vale novels, and he just came out with his latest book, which is Hard Target, which is going to be in hardcover in July, but the ebook and the trade paperback are already out. Alan, great to have you. How you doing again? Been a long time since we last talked, which was with your last book, Inmate 1577, the number four in the Karen Vale novel. And you just keep going, baby. And how you doing?
I'm doing great, John. And it's great to be back on your show.
Yes. And so here we go. Hard Target. Like I said, you know, it's another Karen Vale novel. You have a lot of things that are going on set. I mean, I think you've pretty much almost outdone yourself in the fast pace where you have just thrown the reader into it, and you really didn't let them go until the end, even if you really did let them go. Was that kind of your plan when you decided to do it, was to just sit there and just make them hold on for dear life?
Well, you know, the story lends itself to that. I put a lot of things in motion, all simultaneously, and there are things going on that you don't realize are going on, you know, behind the scenes, which is something that I like to do. And it all comes together probably two-thirds of the way through, and then the last third of the novel is all these parts and storylines that converge. And, yeah, it is kind of like a mad dash. And a few readers have emailed me and said, gosh, this felt like a 24 story.
Yeah.
I wasn't intending that, but the subject matter of the novel itself is kind of that type of story.
You know, and that leads me to something that I wrote, because kind of like my letter from the editor this month, which is going to be in the July magazine, I kind of talked about writer's block, but I also talked about how stories kind of changed while the author is writing it. And you don't even really realize it's changed or when it happened, and all of a sudden you get into it a little bit and you're like, what the hell just happened? This is not what I originally thought. And like you just said, that you didn't really expect it to kind of be like a 24. Was that something that surprised you? And then when you realized that it was kind of going this way, you said, this is working, and then you just kept doing it.
Well, I outline my novels before I start writing, so I have a pretty good sense as to what I'm dealing with when I start to write it. That said, a couple of things. One is, when I'm outlining it, that happens to me. The story takes on different life than I had originally planned when I came up with the initial thought. So that, yes, absolutely happens as I'm outlining it. That's also said, while I'm writing the novel, I mean, it's a dynamic process and it's organic. So even though I have an outline, once the characters start opening their mouths and speaking, you
yeah.
don't really know what's going to happen until it's happening, even though you know what's going to happen in the scene. So the chemistry between the characters, and this is something that I've learned now over the 18, 19 years of writing. I can't believe it's been that long, but
I know.
You know, you start to learn things about yourself as a writer. And one thing that I've learned is to listen to my inner voice. I talk to myself, and I guess we all do it, but I think that we, most of the time, ignore what we're saying to ourselves. And I did that for so many years while writing. And it was only maybe 3 or 4 years ago that I stopped and I said, wait a minute. You just said something here. Wait, you're saying this scene is not working. Stop. Go back.
Yeah.
Why is it not working? You know? So once I learned to do that and became aware of my inner voice, it really focused me. I didn't realize I had an editor sitting on my shoulder. And once I started listening to that, I think it became a much easier process for me because I could identify places where X should happen instead of Y. And it started happening during the writing of the initial draft, and it made for a much, much better storytelling experience for me and the reader.
Are you there, Alan?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah.
Okay. And the one thing also that I've noticed, because the other thing is, because, you know, Karen Vell is, you know, this is her book number 5, but the one thing that you do, and again, we're talking with Alan Jacobson here, and his website is alanjacobson.com, is you always list kind of your main characters, and you've done that again here for Hard Target, and you kind of have your main characters that are all set there. So besides Karen Vale, which one of those characters would you sit there and say, you know what, it really surprised me that they had a stronger voice than I kind of thought they were going to, and it was kind of very enjoyable?
Well, first, I wouldn't call this the fifth Karen Vale novel. It is, she is in it, obviously, and she's in a lot
right.
of it. But this is the story behind our Hard Target is that back when The Seventh Victim came out, I gave my editor at Vanguard Press the draft that I had at the time of Hard Target. And he looked at it and he said, well, this isn't exactly a Karen Vale novel. Can you make it a Karen Vale novel? And I said, well, you know, it's not really her story. She's in it, and she plays a major role, but it's not her story. And he said, well, can you make it her story? And, you know, I didn't want to say no, but I said, let me think about it. And I thought about it. I looked it over thoroughly, and I said, you know, I love it the way it is. It is, to me, very close to a perfect novel. I would not want to screw it up, so to speak, by trying to rewrite it into something that it's not supposed to be. And without going into the details of the story and give things away,
right.
there's a very specific reason why it is the story of FBI agent Aaron Uziel, or Uzi, that's
mm-hmm.
everybody calls him Uzi. So
I like the pun on the words there.
Yeah, it was
yeah,
such a natural.
Exactly.
So I told him no, and he said, okay, then write us another Karen Vale novel, and that's when I wrote Crush, and then Velocity, and then Inmate 1577. I had this train that was hurtling down the tracks, and everybody said, more Karen Vale, more Karen Vale. So we put it off, and what ended up happening was I ended up rewriting Hard Target last year because I knew I wanted it to come out, and there had been so many changes in the world of, in the political theater and in the terrorism theater that I found that I had to rewrite so much of the novel. And I'm glad I did, because, you know, you see things that you didn't see before, and it was a fresh look at it, and I love the changes that I made. And I actually did get Karen Vail into it more than I had anticipated. It's still not her story. It's Uzi's story. But in terms of the question you asked, yes, what happened with that was Uzi, in this novel, in Hard Target, he teams with Hector DeSantos, who's a character that keeps coming back in my novels, even though I never anticipated doing that. So
right.
DeSantos is a covert, a black operative for the Department of Defense, and he debuted in my second novel, The Hunted. And something happened to him in The Hunted, and it follows through the vein of who this character is. He carries it with him like baggage, emotional baggage. And so he comes back in Velocity, which is the third Karen Vail novel, and he teams with Karen Vail. And I originally, that was part of the outline. That was supposed to happen. But what I didn't bank on was the chemistry between the two of them that, you know, we were talking about a few minutes ago. And so that totally changed my attitude and the tone of Velocity, because you had Karen Vail, who was hell-bent on getting something done because of something that had happened to her. I wouldn't say it was revenge, and it wasn't, but that emotion, that sense of urgency played a role. And then you had DeSantos, who was usually the cold, calculating type of sorts when he's doing his work, trying to temper that and keep her in check, which was very much unlike him as a character. So when you stress characters, when you strain them and do different things with them, great things happen. And that's what happened in Velocity. So now that chemistry with Hard Target carried over between Vail and DeSantos and now Uzi. Now the Uzi and DeSantos have this terrific relationship. I mean, they're buds, you know. They haven't seen each other
right.
for years, and stuff had happened to Uzi in the interim, and that's his backstory. But now we've got, you know, these three characters that are working together, and the chemistry between Uzi and DeSantos is just fabulous. And I've had really tremendous feedback to Uzi, something that I hadn't picked up on or intended. The female readers are finding that they're attracted to him in a very interesting way that I couldn't have been aware of while I was writing it. But it's there, and that's pretty cool.
And you know, and that's one thing that, because a lot of authors listen to our show, because we do have fabulous authors, you know, New York Times bestselling authors like yourself. Again, everybody, we're speaking with Alan Jacobson. We're discussing the latest book called Hard Target, which will be out in hardcover in July, which will be late July. But it's also available right now in ebook, trade paperback, or to alanjacobson.com and Amazon, Kindle, all those places to find it. But there's one thing that you mentioned, like I said, a lot of authors listen to the show, and like you just said, you didn't realize that the chemistry between DeSantis and Vail was going to have such a broad, you know, such an effect on when you started writing. How do you know as an author, when is that point when you decide and you sit there and you go back and you read, did someone tell you, hey, these two characters really work together, or was it just when you're going back and maybe rereading it for the next book? Because a lot of authors, you know, you have to reread to make sure that you get your, you know, your facts and your things right. You didn't mess things up. How, I mean, is it just a light? I mean, how does that happen? How do those things just happen?
I know it while I'm writing it. It's an amazing thing when it happens, and I literally get excited. I mean, I'm writing, and I can't write fast enough because the banter, the interplay, the interaction between two characters is so terrific that you literally can't type fast enough to get it out. You know, your brain is just firing, and you're so into the scene. And I remember this happening in the second Karen Vail novel, Crush. And this, you know, talk about going back to what you said earlier about things taking over and changing what you had intended. In Crush, Karen Vail goes to the Napa Valley, and she is dealing with a murder there, a serial killer. And there's a major task force set up, which is how the Napa County Sheriff's Department actually does it. And in walks this woman. And initially, what my intention was that Karen Vale and Roxanne Dixon would not hit it off, and they'd kind of butt heads, and there would be this, you know, almost catty competition. I hate to call it that because that wasn't really, you know, how I intended it, but they would be almost like butting heads, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote that, and that's how the scene started. By the time I finished that chapter, they had a camaraderie, they were friends, it was amazing, and I continued with it, and the chemistry between the two of them, I knew it immediately.
Right.
When I finished that scene, I kind of stepped back and I went, wow, okay, I got to rethink this, because I was going to have Vale partner with one of the male detectives on the task force. And I continued with it, and I sent the first 50 pages to my editor, and I didn't say anything to him about it, right? So I sent it off, and he calls me 2 days later, and he goes, Alan, what the hell is going on with Karen Vale and Roxanne Dixon? This is incredible. I love this. And I said, okay, you see it too. That's good, because
okay,
I
good.
Felt it. Yeah. And it was so evident. He said, you're going to continue with this, right? I said, absolutely. He goes, good, good. This is great stuff. And readers have picked up on it as well. So I get comments all the time. Is Roxanne Dixon going to be in another book? You know, I want to see more Roxanne Dixon with Karen Vale. So that was very exciting. And I did bring her back in Velocity, the third Karen Vale novel, and in May 1577, the fourth Karen Vale novel. So I was able to get both of them back together, and that was great fun. But Hard Target, they're not. Roxanne Dixon is not it.
Yeah, because we talked a little bit about, because I guess, you know, the one thing that you don't want to have happen and is to start going a direction and you spend so much time, and then all of a sudden it's like, damn, it's not really working, and then you kind of feel a little frustrated where it's like, oh, you know, I wasted all this time and it didn't really work out very well, and so then you kind of have to change gears and rework everything, and that can be very frustrating. And a lot of authors, some authors will just keep going on it, and then that just makes for a bad book. And I always would tell somebody, no, don't put something out that you're not comfortable with saying, yeah, this is 100% into it. And if it's not working, stop. Just stop and redo it. There's been many times, I mean, there's a novel that I'm writing myself now. Well, I was, you know, about 30,000 words into it, and I said, this is not working. I scrapped the whole damn thing, and I just started over again. And, you know, sometimes you have to do those things. Sometimes you have to be, but I think you have to be self-editing and smart enough to realize it ain't happening and just scrap it and redo it. Because they don't always work. They work really good for me in the bathroom, but then when I put on the page, it just didn't work.
No, you're absolutely right. There are authors who will force their way, write their way through it, and then go back and try to fix it. That's another approach. I kind of know in my outline if something's not working before, and that's why I outline, because I don't want to have a situation where I have spent, you know, weeks working on something that is not going anywhere. And you know, one of the beauties of writing a series, and I never thought I would say this because my intention was to never, ever, ever write a series.
I
talked about this in the past. And I have to say that I'm glad my publisher forced me to do it, because I love the Karen Vale series. I'm extremely proud of every one of those novels, and I love her as a character and the world that I've created, world of characters that I've created with her. So it's easier in that I know that with Karen Vale, I have a dynamic character who can make things happen. And by the very nature of who she is, when she steps into a room, things are going to happen. And it enables me as the author to tell a compelling story when you have a character who makes things happen. If you had a character that walks into the room and you know, there's a potential for a boring scene or a scene that's just not going anywhere, that could be a problem. Fortunately, with these characters that I have, they all have a dynamism to them that, you know, you look at Uzi, I mean, he's very, very dynamic and very complex guy. DeSantis, I mean, you know, he's he's carried out a lot of black ops over the years and done things that maybe he shouldn't be proud of, and some things that he's incredibly proud of. And then you have Karen Vail, who, you know, she finds a way of always meaning well, but not always doing the right thing that's best for Karen Vail, and gets herself in hot water a lot as a result. So, and she, you know, the things that these people deal with. Uzi is head of the Joint Terrorism Task Force for the FBI in Washington, D.C. That right there, I mean, he's going to be in the thick of any kind of terrorist plot. The politics that goes on in D.C. are amazing, and I explored some of that in Hard Target. So there's so much going on with each one of these characters in my world that I've been building. It's very exciting, and it enables me to prevent those "oops, this isn't working" moments, and I'm grateful for that, because those are not fun, I would imagine.
No, they're not. And then, you know, and the one thing, kind of switching gears a little, because your last book, you know, you mentioned Inmate 1577, and for people that don't realize, you know, that book was set Alcatraz.
Yeah.
You know, you can read about all the setting, but it was basically set in Alcatraz, San Francisco, and everything that was going on with Inmate 1577. But have you had, and arguably, it was probably listed as one of your best books that you've written. I mean, I have to say that I would, that's the favorite of mine. And the reason why is because I love to have the real life setting set in a fictional way with your character.
Yep.
Now, have you had any plans of thinking, because I've always wondered, why can't somebody write a story, and I thought it would be neat to say, you know what, I'm going to go chase Jack the Ripper with Jack Reacher, or somebody like that, or Karen Vail is going to go chase Ted Bundy down, or anything to that thing, and kind of bring both of those fictional and real life together to see how. Do you have any plans to kind of do another book where you are setting kind of that real life situation like you are in Alcatraz and things like that? Because it was very close to kind of like an historical fiction where, it was outstanding. And if people didn't read it yet, then shame on you.
Yeah, Inmate 1577 was one of those novels that you know you've got lightning, and you know, you try to execute properly, not get in the way of the story you're telling, because it's just, It's such a perfect story, and the reaction that you just had is the reaction I get from almost everybody across the board who's read Inmate 1577. It basically, for your listeners, it was a story told in two tracks, one in the 1950s, 1960s, about this man whose wife is murdered. He's got a young son. The son witnesses the murder, and he is arrested for the crime and eventually found not guilty. But not guilty is not the same as innocent, and it's a pariah around his neck. He has difficulty getting a job and has to resort to bank robbery to support them. So that's that track. And then the other track is present-day San Francisco, where victims are being found, elderly victims, victims of serial killer in the city. And Karen Vail is sent to San Francisco to help the SFPD to unravel this and figure out what the heck is going on here. And the two storylines eventually converge. And as you said, a lot of it is set on Alcatraz, which was, ironically, that right there was my jumping off point. The idea that I had was Karen Vail on Alcatraz. That was the initial idea. And I went, oh, that's really cool. And I wrote it down.
You just had to get her there. You just had to get her there somehow.
Yeah, there needs to be a reason, and a good reason. And there were other logistics that had to work with that. And as the days, because I wasn't going to write this novel. I was going to write something else. But this idea came in, and it was just like, wow, that's pretty exciting. So I typed it up and put it aside, said, okay, that's good. You know, someday I'm going to write that. And then the next day, more ideas came to me. Opened up the document, continued typing, put it aside. That's good. You know, someday I'm going to write this book. Next day, more ideas. This happened for a week until I had a pretty darn good outline. And I went, I'm writing this book now.
There you go.
It was just too good to put it aside. So I ended up writing Inmate 1577 right then and there. And the yes, there. So my character is part of the famous 1962 escape with the Anglin brothers and Frank Morris, which just had its 60th anniversary, I think. And
something like that.
So,
I know they just had a thing on Yahoo. They were just talking about the three that escaped,
right.
Because I guess when they reach 100, that the warrants are no longer void anymore. They're going to be void.
Right.
So if they actually did make it, so I just saw that story too. So yeah, they were talking about did they actually make it or not. Of course, there's conspiracy theories on both sides. No, there's no way they could have, or yes, they did. So who knows?
Yeah, exactly. And it was
a great
very
mystery, though.
It was fun for me to explore the whole book isn't about that, but it plays a prominent role because of something that happens to my character during that escape. And so it was very fun for me. I spent a great deal of time. I worked with one of the surviving correctional officers who's really sharp and just a heck of a nice guy. And I went to Alcatraz with him, and we spent the day there, and he took me around and told me stories that, we're standing in the place where a guy was murdered, and George was in the middle of it, and
right.
So he's telling me the story. We're standing right there because, it's largely intact. The cell house is there the way it was.
Right.
So it was, I spent a tremendous amount of time on the island, and I really, really got into it, the history. And I was, everything that's in there is true to form. I researched it very heavily, as I do for all my books, but I wanted to make sure that one historically was correct. And Inmate 1577 was a lot of fun for me to write. Hard Target was too, to be honest with you. That pacing was just so exciting for me, and getting into the politics of the story I was telling, which I have not done in the past, but I worked with a lot of prominent people and researched it heavily with the FBI and terrorism experts and political experts, and it's a very fun story, as you said, and 24-ish,
right.
I guess, in the pacing.
Well, I'll tell you what, Alan, we want to thank you so much for coming on. Alan Jacobson, everybody, the book is Hard Target. The website is alanjacobson.com. Check it out. Alan, it's always a pleasure to have you on, and, we'd love to have you on again, of course. So anytime, email us, let us know, and we'll talk with you soon. So thanks again so much.
Thanks, John, and happy Father's Day, everybody.
Yes, and you too, and have a good day, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, John, take care.
All right, bye-bye. Again, everybody, Alan Jacobson, alanjacobson.com. The book is Hard Target. We are going to be back here with our next guest coming up in just 1 second. So in the meantime, here you go. welcome back, everybody, here out of our first break, and we are going to be joined now by our next guest, Eric Van Lustbader. He has taken over the reins to write. Many of you, of course, know who Jason Bourne is and the Bourne series from Robert Ludlum. And the latest book that Eric has written is called The Bourne Imperative, came out June the 5th. So, Eric, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, John. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So, of course, everybody loves to know. Everybody knows Jason Bourne, and they know the series because they know Matt Damon playing the movies, and now they're re-upping it again, coming out with, I think, The Bourne Legacy is going to be the latest one that's going to come out here in the theaters. So that gives you a nice little boost, but, of course, a lot of people always like to know, how did you fall into being able to be a part of, you know, such a fabulous, you know, series in Jason Bourne, one of the most recognizable characters now in action movies?
Well, I didn't fall into it. I was asked to do it because Bob and I were very good friends, and we met in 1980 when the Bourne Identity came out, and my first big blockbuster, The Ninja, came out. Bob and I shared an agent, Henry Morrison, and in those days, Henry had these wonderful parties for his authors. And in one of them, Henry came up to me and said, Bob Ludlum would like to meet you. And I was really surprised because at that point in time, Bob's reputation preceded him, and he was really pretty much of a curmudgeon and wasn't very sociable and really didn't particularly like too many people. So I was really surprised, and it turned out that he had read The Ninja, loved it, and we spent the entire evening talking about characters, how Jason Bourne and my character, Nicholas Lanier, had shared similar qualities of honor and trust. And we talked about how we created character arcs, how we created the plot structures for thrillers, and we just, you know, from the minute we met, we just got on, and we kept up a friendship. But it was difficult, and especially in later years, keeping up a friendship with Bob because he moved down to Florida and he was really kind of involved in what he was doing. But we stayed in touch, and when he passed away in 2001, I was having lunch with my accountant, who was also Bob's accountant, and it turned out he's the executor of Bob's estate. And the Bourne Identity had come out a year before as a film, and he said to me, "What are you going to be doing next?" And I said, I don't really know. I'm not really sure. He said, "How'd you like to write a Jason Bourne novel?" And I said, "Huh? What?" And he said, "Well, I got this idea. You know, the films are doing really well. The second one is going to be starting shooting, and I thought it would be a great idea to have a new Jason Bourne novel come out at the same time as the next Jason Bourne film." And I thought that was a no-brainer. I thought that was just a great idea because
right.
They spend about $500,000, I don't know, or maybe more, on publicity right before the film comes out. And, you know, you can piggyback on that, which there's no publisher around that's going to be spending, you know, $500,000 or $1 million on advertising.
No way.
So I said, "Well, you know, I really don't know. I said, I'm not a gun for hire. I don't want to be writing in." I said, "If you want me to write in Bob's style, you got the wrong person, because I just don't do that." And he said, "No, well,
right.
I want you to write it in your own style." And I said, "But I'm not a ghostwriter, so I don't, you know, I'd like my name on it." And he thought about it for about, you know, 10 seconds, and he said, "Fine." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, let me think about it overnight." And I went home, talked to my wife about it, and she said, "You know, if it's going to make you happy, do it. If not, you know, you have your regular career. You don't really need to do it." And next morning, I got into the shower, and when I got out, I had the plot for the Bourne Legacy, which was actually the first book a Bourne book that I wrote. Now in my seventh or eighth book, I think Imperative is the seventh book, and so I've been it was originally going to be every time a film came out, which was, you know, every two or three years, but by the time Legacy came out, it did so well that the publisher said, you know what, we'd really like to have a Bourne book every year. And
you're like, oh, okay,
thanks for that. Well, I wasn't prepared for that because I have my own series,
right,
as you know.
Right, you got your own series.
And I thought, I don't know whether I can, honestly, I don't know whether I can write two books a year. And I said, well, let me try it and see if I can do it. And it turns out I have been able to do it. So we've been doing a book a year ever since then, and I've been doing a book a year on my own Jack McClure series ever since then, and that's the way it's gone, and it's been incredibly successful, much more than when other people take over late writers' series. I mean, the books were immediately huge, and start a week from, although you said the Imperative came out on the 5th, and starting a week from tomorrow, it'll be on the Times bestseller list, along with the paperback of the previous book, The Bourne Dominion. And
that's fabulous.
This day and age, it's very difficult to have simultaneous hardcover and paperbacks on the New York Times list. So I'm very excited about that, as is my publisher, as you can imagine.
Oh, I mean, yeah, authors would love to just get one if they write 20, if they just have one that's even mentioned, to have two simultaneously at the same time. I don't even know if you could have even dreamed that, you know, something like that was ever going to happen.
Well, I've been a best-selling author for over 30 years, so it's happened a couple of times before, but it hasn't happened in a while, and it's a very exciting, whenever it does happen, it's an extremely exciting experience.
It feels like the first time again, like Forner says. It feels like the first time.
Yes, born again. Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry. People use that all the time, and I really shouldn't, but, you know, sometimes the circumstance calls for it.
Oh, absolutely. And like you mentioned, and a lot of people, you know, of course they know Jason Bourne, but the one characters that they might not know, because you've written three books now, this is your third book called Blood Trust, with your Jack McClure and Allie Carson novels. You know, how is that kind of, I guess, you know, different? So when people want to go and they say, oh, you know, he's writing Jason Bourne, so it's going to be kind of the same thing. What are kind of the differences and the similarities between your two series that your readers will definitely be able to know if they haven't picked up the Jack McClure and Allie Carson novels?
Well, one of the things about the Jack McClure books is that they're more personal to me. You know, I wouldn't have taken over the Bourne books unless I knew the Bourne character inside and out from reading the Bourne books, but more importantly, talking to Bob about it. But on the other hand, the Jack McClure books, Jack McClure has more of me in him, and the Allie Carson character, who starts out as she's the president's daughter, is really based on my goddaughter Jessica, who has grown up with Allie in these books, these successive books. And as you pointed out, Blood Trust is the third book. It's the paperback is coming out in July. And then in September, the fourth book, Father Night, comes out. And that really completes the four books that have wrap up Allie's character. And you know, the relationship between McClure and Allie are very much the relationship that I have had with my goddaughter. And so there's a lot of both of us in the novels, and to me it makes it really much more real and immediate, and it's one of the things that I really love. The other thing about it is that Jack McClure is dyslexic, and so am I. So I put what I thought of as a detriment, but it's turned out to be a real positive thing. And I've made that the same way for Jack. I had really thought, and I've gotten a lot of email from parents of children who are dyslexic, who have really thanked me for bringing to light a lot of what dyslexia is about and how to handle their children. Because just because a child has difficulty reading doesn't mean he's slow. As a matter of fact, most of the great minds throughout history were dyslexic, including Einstein, Da Vinci, I could go down a whole list. I don't have it to hand, but part of what dyslexia does is that the brain runs so fast that it really sees everything in three dimensions. So that's why reading is difficult, because a person with dyslexia normally will look at a page and see, I don't know, it'll look like cryptography. It'll look like a swirling. They won't be able to see it correctly. But if you train them to see each letter in three dimensions, which you can do, and then fit them into words and then sentences and whatever, they can learn to read. And but their brains go so fast, and they make so many incredible connections that people without dyslexia can't. That's why a lot of these people who have made tremendous leaps forward in history have been dyslexic, because their minds have been able to make those tremendous leaps that other people can't.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and just to be able to overcome those kinds of things is story enough, but then to be able to go on and do great things is just makes that, you know, always just a little bit more special. We're speaking here with Eric von Lustbader. The latest book, he's the writer right now of the Born series. The latest book was out on June 5th, The Born Imperative, and along with his other series, Blood Trust, comes out in paperback here soon, too. Be able to get all those. EricVonLustbader.com is the website to go to. So when you're kind of, you know, like you said, when you're writing two books a year and you have two different series and there's two different things going on, just, you know, just kind of like a funny thing. I mean, how many kind of plots do kind of all of a sudden accidentally cross over in your mind and you're like, oh, shoot, no, that's supposed to go on this one, not on this one?
I've actually never had that happen. I can't write the two books simultaneously. Then what you're saying would happen all the time. I'd get confused as to what plot is what. Every once in a while I will think of a character and say, oh, wait a minute, that character doesn't belong in this book, it belongs in the other book. But not a plot device. I've never had that happen, because, you know, part of when you write a series, it's very different from a standalone novel. You really have to think about the macro elements, in other words, the entire universe in which your characters exist. And you can't think book by book, because you're always, at least I am, I'm always seeding things in the book I'm writing that will come to fruition in the following book. So you have to think of it as an overall arc, and think about the overall journey that your character is taking. And that's one of the fun things about series that you can't get in standalone books, because you can really create this larger universe that you don't have time to do in standalone books. And it's one of the things that I really love.
And the thing that I always find interesting, especially from, you know, authors that are doing multiple series, like you said, are being able to kind of, you know, put those two things aside. But how often, maybe not a crossover, but like you're writing a Bourne series and all of a sudden you're like, well, this isn't really going to work in here. Oh, but it might work over here. So you kind of get the same ideas that can kind of move back and forth, you know, between your stories and your writing, because even though they're, you know, the writings are it's the same author writing, it's two very, very different voices, and to keep them separate is a monumental task in and of itself.
Well, it is monumental, but you know, I have a helpful guide, and that is that in the Bourne novels, I'm writing someone else's character. Now, it's true that every other character in the Bourne novels now are my own characters, and my friend Jeff, who is the executive of the state, has said that Bourne's now my character. But the fact is, I have certain guidelines that I have to adhere to, because that I have to stay true to the character, and I want to stay true to the character. I mean, it would be a tremendous disservice to Bob if I didn't. And so every once in a while, I'll be talking to my agent, because he was also, as I said, Bob's agent, and I'll say, "Do you think this works for Bourne?" And if he says no, I might think about it for Jack. And in that sense, there can be things going across. But other than that, there's a strict barrier, because I can do anything I want with Jack McClure. I can't do everything I want. You know, one of the things that happened was in the first book, The Bourne Legacy, I proposed that Bourne had his son from a previous marriage that Bob actually talked about was still alive, and he became a character in the book, and I really loved him. And since then I've gotten so many emails from fans who say, you know, can he come back? We really love him. And that's one of the things that my agent said to me. No, he said, this is, you're not writing Batman and Robin. You're writing Bourne, and he's a loner, and that's part of who he is. So we don't want we don't want his son back. And I've tried to explain that to readers, and for the most part, when I write them back, they really understand the parameters under which I'm writing. But they really give me very, very few guidelines like that. I mean, I'm pretty free to do pretty much whatever I want. I mean, I can't change Bourne's real identity. I can't, you know, there are certain things I can't do. But
sure.
One of the things I said to them in the beginning was, you know, Bob never meant Jason Bourne to be a serial character. He wrote the Bourne identity, and that was it. He was already big, very well known, and a big bestseller when he wrote it. But that book put him on another level of success. And naturally, his publishers wanted him to continue writing Bourne books, and he said, "No, I don't want to do it." And for a long time, he didn't. But then, I mean, I guess about 5 years after he wrote The Bourne Identity, he came up with an idea, and he called his agent, and he said, you know, I can really do this as a standalone or a Bourne. What should I do? And his agent said, do it as a Bourne novel, and he did The Bourne Supremacy. But by that time, Bob, who started writing when he was older, because he was a stage producer and actor and earlier on in his career, was already fairly old, and he made Bourne kind of, also, because he thought of Bourne as himself, as he said to me, and not surprisingly, he made him a little bit older. He had him married to Marie. He had two kids. And that's not what you want from a serial character, especially someone like Bourne, because how many times can you have Marie kidnapped or the kids in jeopardy, or, you know, what are you going to do with them with every book? And I said to my agent, listen, I'm going to do this series. We have to think long term about this. And we've got to do something about Marie and the children. And we have to do something about the readers who are going to come to this series because they loved the Bourne films. And they're seeing a different kind of Bourne than Bob created in the books. And I have to find a way to sort of meld the two together so that he's recognizable, but the older readers are going to recognize him as well. So in the Bourne Legacy, I took two of the characters from Bob's and killed them off in the first 5 minutes, so people who knew the books would feel, you know, comfortable knowing that those characters, and then move on from there so that the characters, the readers from the films would feel comfortable as well. And it's worked out very, very well. I mean, Marie died between the first two books, and the children were shipped off to her parents in they quite conveniently, Bob had them have a big ranch in the wilds of Canada, so they're off there, and that set him free to meet women and to do all the things he needed to do without worrying about what was going to happen to his family, because it wouldn't be fair to the character really or the readers, because they'd, you know, it's, you're going to get bored with that. As I said,
I mean, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you can only go to that well so many times. I mean, you know, Jason Bourne is right now the modern day James Bond.
Right.
I mean, let's face it. I mean, that's what he is. And the action is amped up, you know, double from what the old Bond movies were. And then the Bond movies now are trying to catch up to more action and things with the new Daniel Craig. But, you know, Jason Bourne with Matt Damon kind of started. So, yeah, you can only go to that well too many times before people are like, we've seen this before. You can't keep doing the same
exactly.
thing over and over.
Exactly. So part of my job is to make each book fresh and exciting and to mirror, you know, as thrillers ought to do, what's happening in the world today and staying maybe hopefully one or two steps ahead of what's happening in the world today. And I feel
yeah,
the same way with the Jack books. You know, you have to
yeah.
keep everything fresh and everything new. And part of what I like to do is to really educate people about things without them really knowing it. If people learn things while they're being entertained, they retain everything. I mean, it's just
yes,
the easiest way to learn. And it turns out that in Bourne Dominion, the necessary plot device revolves around rare earth metals, which are used in, actually they're not metals, they're elements, which are used in all the cell phones, in hybrid cars, in wind turbines, in computers, in all, every one of the new military weaponry coming out. And China holds 97% of the rare earths in the world. And there is a without getting too complicated into it, but there is an American rare earth mine, and that becomes the focus of the Bourne Dominion. And because of that, I got contacted by people in Washington who want me to come down and speak to the Rare Earth Senatorial Committee to get them more involved in how strategically important America having rare earths, their own rare earths, is. And that's one of the really exciting things about writing, is when you touch a nerve that creates interest in the real world and people want you to come down and speak about it.
Yeah, that's got to be just kind of cool. I mean, because sometimes when you're writing kind of political thrillers, and, you know, we've spoken with many of them, you're almost having to go through the government to kind of sit there and say, can I put this in, can I not put this in? But to be able to be contacted, because you're the one who found the information, and then you're the one that's going to be, like, the expert in it, I mean, that's just kind of amazing. You just kind of think, you know, thinking about that, it's just kind of, you know, kind
well,
of mind-boggling.
That's why it sort of annoys me, and it's part of why I'm part of the International Thriller Writers Organization.
Right.
When we talked about how we met there a couple of years ago, is that it just annoys me that certain people feel that thrillers are a kind of genre and unbelievable kind of novels. And the fact is, everything I write about is real and is believable. I mean, it's certainly true that some of the things that Bourne does may not be possible for the normal person, but it's certainly within the realm of possibility for people who are highly trained.
Right.
But the fact is that everything I write about is based on fact and actually teaches people about things that they don't know. That's rare, the rare earths is a very good example of that. It's just part of my crusade to try to make people understand how relevant thrillers are in the present day world.
Well, you know, real quick, because we got maybe like 30 seconds left. What do you got coming up here, you know, into the future? You know, what is 2013 going to hold? Are we going to see again another Bourne book and then another Jack McClure and Ali Carson book? Is that what you're
As I said, it's in September, the fourth Jack McClure book is coming out. It's called Father Night. I just today finished the fifth Jack McClure book. And next month I'll be starting the next Bourne book, which will be out next year at this time. But I wanted to let you know just very quickly that I'm very active on Facebook and on Twitter, and I'm the first author to do Twitter adventures, and I'm in the middle of a Jason Bourne Twitter adventure right now. So if people want to get onto Twitter and get onto my site, they'll be able to read an all-new adventure that has you can't get anywhere else.
Well, Eric, we want to thank you so much for coming on. The books are fabulous. It's so nice you to be on here today.
My pleasure, John.
Good luck at Thriller Fest. And, again, you know, we will catch up with you in the future. And, again, thank you so much.
My pleasure, John. Anytime.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, again, everybody, that is Eric von Lustbader, the author of now the Jason Bourne series, which, of course, you know, there's a new Jason Bourne movie coming out with Jeremy Renner, but also his own series, and Jack McClure and Ali Carson, like you said, the book Blood Trust will be out here in paperback. It's already been out. The Bourne Imperative came out June 5th. And go to ericvonlustbader.com to check everything out. Like he said, something very active on Facebook and Twitter, missing out on some great tweets that he has with the Jason Bourne adventure going on. Very active author, very ingenious and intuitive. So you want to make sure that you definitely have Eric von Lustbader on your list, and it's summer coming up, so there's no excuse. We are going to here take another quick break, and we're going to be back with our next guest, Rick Reed, who has written his next book, Coldest Fear. And right now we want you to go ahead and listen to an audio clip that we had sent in by Lawrence O'Brien. It's called The Istanbul Puzzle. So here you go.
The Istanbul Puzzle, by Lawrence O'Brien. Chapter 1, read by the author. Icy sweat streamed from Alex's pores. He'd been optimistic, way too optimistic. Kidnapping in the Islamic world was almost always a form of extortion, so he'd been told. But the appearance of the knife, big enough to gut a bear, had changed everything. He shook his head in disbelief. Only an hour ago he'd been happy in his hotel room, a place that was now as unreachable as a childhood dream. His heart banged against his ribs, as if it wanted out. He looked around. Was there someone else in the pillared hall he could appeal to? The bead-like eye of the video camera blinked on. Alex's arms and legs jerked, straining at the orange nylon rope binding him to the smooth pillar. Musty air filled his nostrils. He was trembling, as if he had a fever. When the two men had entered his room, he'd gone with them quietly. How stupid he'd been. Why hadn't he shouted, roared, jumped for the window? He'd seen the look in this bastard's eyes, as hard as stone. Now it was too late. "Let me go!" he screamed. His voice echoed. A hand held his shoulder. He threw his head from side to side, straining his neck. The rope around his ankles, knees, and chest held him tight. His pulse thumped against it. The knife glistened in the air like falling water. Only the prayer his mother had taught him could help him now. Agios Othias, Agios Osarkos, Agios Othantos, Ilios Anamas. Holy God, holy and mighty, holy and immortal, have mercy on us. He closed his eyes. Iciness hit his neck. Then a hot torrent fell on his chest. Warmth gushed down his legs, soaking him. A foul smell rose around him, and an eerie calm descended. He looked around the ancient hall, taking in its forest-like rows of pillars. The entrance he'd found must have been sealed up over 500 years ago, before the ancient city of Constantinople above him fell to a Muslim army, and its name was changed to Istanbul. There were treasures down here any museum director in the world would beg for, but he wished he'd never found the place. He stared at the aluminium tables nearby. What he'd seen on those tables had terrified him. A black mist rushed towards him. Would Sean find out what had happened? Agios Othias, Agios. A minute later, the two fountains of blood, 2 foot high at their peak, from the left and right arteries emerging from Alex's chest, bubbled like cooling coffee percolators. The flesh around them shone with a silky gleam. But Alex's eyes were closed, and his face was peaceful. I hope you enjoyed the rest of the book. The Jerusalem Puzzle will be released January the 17th, 2013.
Glamour, celebrity, and murder. Whether you're looking for mystery or suspense, you'll find it all at Thriller Fast. Open to readers, aspiring writers, and published authors. Learn craft, meet top thriller writers, and enjoy New York City July 11th through the 14th. Jack Higgins, R.L. Stine, Lee Child, Karen Slaughter, Catherine Coulter, Richard North Patterson, John Sanford, Ann Rule, and more. Join them this summer. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.
So I want to welcome everybody back here again. Like you just heard, the Istanbul Puzzle, written there by Lawrence O'Brien. If you want to have your clip on the air, you have to email. We're looking for 2 to 3 minute clips to be played on the air for people's books. And you just send me the MP3. Make sure you include your author information and thing in there. But it's open for free. You just send it over to them. We go ahead and we listen to them. We play them on the air to give you a little bit more publicity to be able to do, whether you record it yourself or whether someone else records it, it's okay. I was a little mistaken. Rick Reed is coming up next. It's our next guest here is author Bruce Holbert, BruceHolbertBooks.com, and the book he's written is Lonesome Animals, a very intriguing thriller that we found out about from his publicist actually emailing us. So, Bruce, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing today?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
So, again, the book Lonesome Animals, it features your character here, Russell Strahl, which is a tormented lawman, comes out of retirement, hunts a serial killer, but you kind of incorporate, the Native American aspect into this. So can you kind of tell everybody a little bit about the book behind the scenes, writing it, and, you know, what exactly it's about.
Yeah, it's it ends up being a combination of a whole bunch of genres, which I didn't really intend, but that's how it turned out. It takes place in the 1930s in the Grand Coulee Dam area, which is the area I grew up in. And the main character is a sheriff or former sheriff named Russell Strahl, and he's kind of on the edge himself. He's not got ran off his job being a sheriff because he was just a little too tough on the criminals. And he describes himself as the West starts to get settled. He describes himself as a mean guard dog with nothing to guard. And then this serial killer shows up, who happens to cut up these bodies in pretty ornate ways, and is troubling to the locals, and so he comes out of retirement to try to hunt this guy. But he's nearly as tough on the people he questions and trying to get information as a serial killer is on his victims. So it's a pretty rough book. It's pretty violent. And that's inherent in the West. You know, that's just part of the myth and the culture out here, and it's something that I grew up in it, so I'm really interested in it. I'm interested in debunking it to a certain extent, because I think it's a myth that, I think it's unhealthy for some people. I think that, you know, if a myth is supposed to teach you how to live, this myth teaches you how to get arrested.
Ah. And, you know, the one thing, when people go on your site, I'm just going to tell you right now, I would retire on that picture. Build a house, and that's what I would look at every morning, because there's just so much, untamed lands out there that is just a gorgeous looking thing. And that's kind of the part that, you know, you're kind of bringing into the book. I mean, you're saying it's violent and this and that, but there's also kind of a beauty, and like you said, a misnomer out there about exactly kind of how things were, that you're trying to debunk some of those, you know, some of those rumors and those legends and those things like that. It had to make it a little more difficult. Was that kind of like your inspiration, not really inspiration, but kind of your motivation to sit there and say, I'm going to write this kind of a thriller, because it is the first one you've ever done. And so something must have just clicked to say, I think this is what I want to do.
Well, I've been writing for quite a while and published a lot of short stories, but most of the stuff that I was doing was maybe considered more literary or less accessible than this book has turned out to be. But I think that this key book came from a couple of places. My great-grandfather murdered my grandfather in land that in the country that my family settled. In fact, it's still named after my family, the road in and the canyon and the creek that runs through it. And it's always been a family kind of, nobody ever talked about it much. And then my dad's the only living sibling from that family, and he started to tell me more and more stuff about it, and I started thinking more and more about, you know, him being almost a victim of the Western myth. He didn't have a father or a grandfather to help raise him, and I started thinking about how to try to write about that. I mean, I knew I couldn't write about my actual great-grandfather because there just wasn't enough there, so I knew he was an Indian scout, and had worked as a policeman in the early reservation days. And so I took that. And the other thing, which may sound strange, I started thinking about Nazi concentration camp guards, how your job at a concentration camp was to do awful things, and you got paid for it, and people would tell you you were doing a good job because you did what you were supposed to do. And there were probably lots of guys who, you know, even kids who went through that. And then they came out the other side, and all of a sudden everything that they were told they were supposed to do and told they were doing for a good reason turns out to be horrible. And I think that's how the myth switched in the West, that all the things that is the stuff that really creates trouble in a modern life.
Now, you've done a lot, you're doing, this is something that is still, you know, new to you, and this is just kind of on the author aspect of, you know, you kind of having to put yourself out there. You've written many short stories, but now when you write a novel and you write one that's kind of, you know, so close to you and so emotional to you, that you kind of have to now put yourself out there, and you're doing publicity like being on our show and things like that. Is it difficult for you to kind of take yourself, I guess, from behind the camera and now have to put yourself in front of the camera to get yourself out? How's that journey been just as yourself as an author to be able to have to do that now?
Well, it's I have to tell you, I'm blessed to a certain extent. I've been a high school teacher for quite a few years. And
well, that hardened you up real fast, I'll tell you that.
Well, it's not just, it's, yeah, it does. Yeah, there's just, yeah, 36 freshmen don't care whether you.
I remember when I was in high school, the shit I used to do on my teachers, so I know well, you know, that yeah. I have respect for high school teachers now. Didn't have respect for them.
And I teach the hard cases, too.
Yeah.
But 36 freshmen don't care if you publish a novel or not.
No.
You know, although I will say that one of the advantages was that my first two or three readings after the book came out were really crowded. They were packed.
Yeah.
Because my students and former students showed up.
Oh.
And so it made that transition into being up in front of people rather than sitting at home in front of my computer. It made that transition a little easier and a little more comfortable because there were a lot of familiar faces there. So I think that's eased it some. It's an odd experience, but I'm grateful for it. I'm glad people are interested in the book, and you know, it's been reviewed pretty well, and I'm grateful to have the chance to talk about it and talk to people.
And that's the one thing that, you know, in today's day and age, while you're an author, and again, we're speaking here with Bruce Holbert, BruceHolbertBooks.com. The book is Lonesome Animals. And so when you're going out, because, you did many events, you did a lot of book signings, and you're continuing to do, you know, book signings coming up through the month of June and July and all the way into October, and people are, you know, having to go out and talk with you. What's kind of the one thing that you get before the book, and then do those same people kind of email you or contact you after the book, and what do they kind of tell you then? Do you kind of see both sides of it now? Are you starting to get, you know, the reaction of all that coming in?
Yeah. I think that questions people have about questions reviewers have had or caveats they've had when reviewing the book have been are things that I sort of expected. I mean, it's a very violent book, and some people want to know, well, who should I root for in this book? And, you know, I don't know. There's not a whole lot of nice guys, and certainly the protagonist is a troubled, mixed up, you know, anti-hero. So,
right. I don't know if we're losing Bruce's signal here real fast. What I will say is maybe we'll see if he comes back on.
I'm here.
Oh, there you are. Okay, I thought we lost your signal for a second because it was kind of muddled. Okay, go ahead. And so we're kind of, you know, talking about, you know, the thing that you're kind of hearing from both sides. You know, what is the one thing that I guess people want to know the most of after they read the book? What are the kind of the questions that they're giving you after they read? Do they need some clarification on things? Is there stuff that they, you know, that they want you to expand on? Are they asking you when, you know, when's the next one? You know, what are you hearing from them?
Oh, I have people ask sometimes about sequels, which is sort of strange because, you know, there aren't a lot of characters left at the end of the book. But,
the Water Boy, you can do the Water Boy. He's going to come back.
Yeah. I suppose one of the questions they ask is, why does the character behave the way he does? One of the, you know, when for the people the book is successful with, they can see exactly why, but they can't really say it because it's sort of ingrained in the whole the myth and the place and the characters. But some people want to know, well, why did Straw fly off the handle and you know, smack his wife in the head with a frying pan? And sometimes they don't, you know, one of the things, chances
how long,
you have
I can
to
answer
take,
that. How long has he been married?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. My answer is, well, he wanted some pepper.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's, they don't, sometimes they don't connect the sort of underlying kind of violence that works with it. But it's a chance you take when you write something, you know, that some people are going to get it and some people aren't.
Now, and how long, you know, did you have the book before you were able to get it, you know, published and get it out there? Was it a long journey? Was it something that, you know, was a little shorter than you expected? How was that kind of journey once you wrote the end?
It was both. I mean, I've been writing for a long time and trying to get a novel together, and then trying to get a solid agent, and I got an agent, and the book sold 10 days later.
Wow.
So it was it took me a long time to get in position to get an agent, and then once I got an agent, one of the first three or four people she sent it to wanted it, so.
And then they come at you, and then they say, you know what, we don't care that it took you 10 years to write your first novel, because now we need number two in 9 months, so let's get that one going.
Yeah. Or they, you know, or you go through the whole process of having to rethink the book because editors have different ideas. I was lucky; I had a really good editor, and you know, we were on the same page. But yeah, it's time to sit down and write another book.
And is that something that, you know, you're doing? Of course, you know, you just mentioned that, you know, you're not going to be doing a sequel, so you're doing another standalone. But is it going to be in the same kind of, you know, subject matter that you did before? You're going way off track on something else. You know, kind of what are you thinking about?
It covers a longer period of time. An amount of it is going to be the same time period that Lonesome Animals takes place in. But it's more, Lonesome Animals is a book that takes place over, you know, a month of the characters' lives, and there's reflections back and forth, but really the standing action only lasts about a month. This is going to be, you know, this is the last 70-some years. So it's different in that aspect, but the setting, and I think some of the, you know, Western, my ideas of Western mythology and Western stories, I think, is similar.
Okay.
It's a little more romantic and a little less violent, which still means it's pretty violent.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, and, but it's beginning to shape up.
So now, as a person, instead, you know, more like an author or whatnot, what kind of books were you drawn to when you were growing up that you read, or kind of TV shows, movies, things like that, that formulated you to becoming, you know, this type of, you know, thriller, more suspense kind of drama author, instead of maybe going a different direction?
Well, I didn't... Growing up, I wasn't around books much, or at least at home anyway. My dad worked construction, and so we had a, you know, 30-foot trailer with wheels, and we just followed the work. And
okay.
books were heavy, and so we didn't want to move
yeah.
them. But when I was my grandmother had a collection of those old Earl Stanley Gardner pulp novels.
Oh.
Upstairs in her upstairs, and there were like hundreds of them. And I have to admit, at first I was attracted to them because they had semi-naughty pictures on them. And, you know, their lurid covers were what I was interested in. But once I started reading them, you know, I really kind of got pulled in by that stuff. And even when I was went to graduate school at the Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa, which is a place that's fairly, oh, they're fairly literary-minded. And even when I was there, I kept, the center of those stories kept pulling me back towards, you know, decisive action and people dealing with their actions, as opposed to a lot of navel-gazing.
And so that's kind of what, you, kind of like the first, I guess, you know, I guess you want to say like your first wave of, you know, getting involved and getting into kind of this strange and weird world that's going on right now, because publishing has changed so much in just you know, just in the past 48 hours probably.
Oh, yeah. It's my editor admits to me that, you know, he's 90% of the time he's guessing what's going on, and that he's like every other editor, and I believe him. You know, there's so much stuff going on, and the book industry is so frightened by a lot of it that you just don't know how to go about, once you've got a book out there, how to go about getting it out where people can hear it. I mean, shows like this have become hugely important. When, you know, they were, I know even 10 years ago when I had friends publishing work, they didn't do as much of this stuff, and they didn't do much stuff on the internet, because in fact, hardly any stuff on the internet. But it's a you know, it's important now, really important.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we started this, not just for the fans, but of course for the authors to be able to get them out, because yeah, there is just really, it's a very limited amount of marketing that they're able to get out there and do, because you have to now, with 8,000 new writers that kind of pop up every year in all different kinds of genres, and being able to put your book out there today on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, how do you be able to capture those readers? Because the number of readers hasn't grown. The number of books have grown. So the pie for authors has gotten shorter. So you kind of have to get yourself, you have to kind of be creative in knowing how to get yourself out to people. And it is, you know, kind of having to do anything and everything, you know, that you can to be able to get yourself out there.
Yeah, and I hired for, you know, somebody named Julia Draper, who was my my publicist. I hired her sort of outside of my pub. There's a publicist that works with me in my publishing house too, but they're she's more print media stuff, and
right.
So I hired Julia, and she built my website, and then she's the one who contacted you and contacted, you know, several internet sites, and she's really been a godsend. Her name's Julia Draper, and she's my hero right now.
Yeah, because we can't find them all. I mean, I scour,
no.
I do a lot of research on my own, but I mean, quite frankly, it would have been very difficult to find, you know, to find you if I didn't get emails from you know, PR people and people out there saying this book is there, and then I go out and then I do the research and then I figure out if it's an interesting kind of topic, and then I say, yeah, sure, you know, that's something that we've never seen before, so let's have, you know, Bruce on. And again, this is Bruce Holbert, BruceHolbertBooks.com, and the book is Lonesome Animals, and, you know, we want to tell everybody to go check that out. But again, kind of switching gears again, you know, just to kind of give everybody more of a rounded, you know, who you are as a person, what are you watching on TV?
Let's see. I don't watch a lot of TV, and that's not because I'm above it. It's because I don't have as much time as I used to have, and also because I have kids who sort of steal a channel changer from me, and so I'm kind of at a loss. But there's a show my son started watching called Breaking Bad that I've been enjoying.
Yeah.
Just partially because you've got a slightly demented school teacher, which I feel like I can identify with.
Right.
I used to like the show House.
And then they got rid of that. Yeah,
it got kind of worn out at the end, but I like the kind of, you know, kind of character he did unexpected things. Let's see. My youngest son watches a lot of documentaries.
What's his, Well, what just came out Wednesday, and I'm just going to let you know because I was extremely excited. Because 9 years old growing up, I used to watch the show, and I followed it all the way through, and they just rebooted it with Dallas.
Yeah.
On TNT. Man, I'll tell you what, they've done a fabulous job. You got JR back, you have Bobby back, the original cast, along with not Victoria Principal. She's the only one who's not there that's still alive on the show. That's not in there. But it's a fabulous thing, and I know it's a drama, but I still, people say it's a soap opera, and I say no. It is a suspense drama away from those daytime soaps. That's what I'm interested in right now.
Well, and it is. It's driven by, the great thing is that show, it sounds like even more than, I've only watched a bit of it and seen some of the commercials, but that show is driven by character.
Absolutely,
you know, by,
all character.
Yeah, and so it's not, you know, a soap opera where all of a sudden something falls out of the sky. It's these bigger than life characters doing bigger than life things.
Right. And as an author, as a novelist like yourself, you have to enjoy the fact that the story is surrounded by character, because sometimes authors say, oh my God, I have this great idea for a book and I want to write it, and so then they start writing it down, they get in the plot, but then they totally forget about their character. And it's like if you have a character that people can relate to, they will stay with you longer than if you kind of have one of those climactic endings that they're like, oh, I didn't see that coming. But but you're forgettable because they're like, oh yeah, but who was in the book? I forget who that name was in the book. And I think that that's a mistake that a lot of authors make.
Yeah, especially new authors. And I think that's one of the things that maybe the way I work was beneficial. I don't plot books out. In fact, in this book, I didn't really know who the killer was until he kind of showed up.
Mm-hmm.
He showed himself as I was working, and it became sort of clear that as I was writing that this was how things were going to shape up. But in that way, you know, I have to make character drive the plot, because I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen next.
Right, and that's one of the things that you definitely have to, when I just talked about earlier, like I said, I wrote in the letter from the editor in the magazine that's coming out in July about writer's block, and the biggest thing that you have to kind of realize from writer's block is sometimes it's not a bad thing. Sometimes it's just the fact of your story went into a direction that you didn't expect it to go.
Yeah.
But that sometimes is not a bad thing, because just because your first thought you thought was fabulous, and then you started writing it, and then people started changing and the voices started changing, maybe you have something great there that you can go ahead and capitalize on.
Yeah, I've learned that whenever something happens I don't expect, that's where the good stuff is.
Right.
You know, that's the stuff that I say, hey, there's something going on here that you're not steering, something bigger's steering, and so you just get out of the way and write.
Yeah, that's what you got to do. Get out of the way and write. That's the biggest thing. That's the thing that I think that authors need to live by is let the characters say what they want to say and get out of their way.
Yeah, the great advantage of being a fiction writer is if they say something you don't want to say, you can cut it out.
Yeah.
You know, later on you can say, well, this went a direction and I didn't want it to go that direction, but if you never go there, you never know what might be there. And most of the time for me, that's the best stuff happens when something sort of occurs spontaneously.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, Bruce, we want to thank you so much for coming on. Everybody, Bruce Holbert, bruceholbertbooks.com is the website. The book is Lonesome Animals. You can get it wherever books are sold. So, Bruce, we want to thank you so much for coming on, and we look forward to seeing what's coming out of you in the future.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Enjoy yourself, and happy Father's Day to you and your family.
Okay, thank you.
All right, bye-bye. So again, everybody, Bruce Holbert. The book is Lonesome Animals, bruceholbertbooks.com. We are going to be back here in just a second with our last guest, author Rick Reed, who's come back out with a book that I have to kind of yell a bit about because I take the bus to work just to say, you know, because gas prices are astronomical, and really, I like to read, and it gives me a good time to read. And I missed my stop by reading his latest book here, so he's going to hear it from me. But in the meantime, like I said, we're going to be right back here. So here's a little musical interlude. Listen to this and have fun. welcome back, everybody. This is our last segment here coming down. It's already been hour and a half. Can't believe that we have flown through this show so quickly. But we want to thank all of our listeners. And I want to go back and thank our guests that we've had on, Alan Jacobson, Eric Von Lustbader, and we just had Bruce Holbert. I want to thank them for joining us today. Fascinating authors, fascinating stories that we have going on. I mean, this is a great time for readers, without a doubt, to be able to get involved, especially with summer and everything coming up, that you have no excuse to not go out and find those great books. Our last author here on the show today is author Rick Reed. He wrote his book, The Coolest Cut, with his character here, Jack Murphy. Came back again with the book, The Coldest Fear. And like we were kind of talking off the air, and I want to welcome Rick to the show. So, Rick, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Just great. Thanks for having me, John.
And like we were kind of talking off the air, there was something about Coldest Fear from Coolest Cut that was different. And I kind of think that it's more along the lines of the maturity of the characters that you kind of see as you go through a series like this. And just from book one to book two, you made me miss my bus stop from reading The Coldest Fear. And that's fine with me, because that's a good thing. If I would have missed it because I was throwing it on the ground, well, that's a bad thing. But I was not. So can you kind of give people a little bit about, Coldest Fear, how the book kind of came together, how Jack's kind of coming together, what's going on? Because, I mean, it's a fascinating story that you got going on here.
Okay. The idea of a series in Evansville, Indiana, was kind of a new thing for me. It's not a large city, even though it's the third largest city in Indiana. But the idea of having a recurring character really appealed to me. So I came up with a detective, Jack Murphy, and his partner is Liddell Blanchard, who is a transplant from Louisiana. I thought they would make for some very interesting stories. And the first book, The Cruelest Cut, introduced all these characters and Jack's ex-wife and some of his background. Then in the next book, in The Coldest Fear, we go back to Jack and Liddell and introduce a little more of Liddell's background, too. And what I'm trying to do is grow these characters in the area where they're at, add some more background theme, if you could put it that way, of Evansville and surrounding areas. So it'll also go outside of Evansville to some of the surrounding counties and surrounding cities. With the idea being to have a long series, maybe 7 or 8 books, if possible.
And what you kind of did here is, you almost kind of amped up, I guess you want to say, even the villain. I mean, the thing that you had here, and your website is rickreedbooks.com. Make sure people know that there's rickreedbooks.com. The one thing that you did, especially with the villain, I mean, you have this intricate killer. I mean, just when people can read, I'm not going to give anything away here. I mean, you kind of have where the first victim, missing the left hand, but shows up on the next person when they had the hand with the blood drain. I mean, what kind of, how did you, I mean, it's okay, to be blunt, how the hell did you think of that one?
I put in almost 30 years in law enforcement, court system, sheriff's department. And I've really been around the block quite a few times. I've worked quite a few homicides. And some of the things that really stuck out to me and stayed in my mind over the years, I have been able to pull into these stories. The idea of somebody leaving a part from one death, leaving it at another scene, it's like a little trail of breadcrumbs. Come and find me. And that's what this guy is doing with Jack, is playing a game with him.
And when and that's the one thing that you can understand, because I guess if you want to, everyone likes to categorize things. So I guess if you want to categorize, it's a thriller police procedural, and that's what you kind of get out of it, because like you said, you have so much history and you have so much experience in doing that. That's kind of like what the character, Murphy is. And how has he been able to kind of mature since your first book, The Cruelest Cut, into Coldest Fear with Murphy? How has that transition happened for you?
When I thought of the idea of having a series, I knew that there were going to be some things of Jack that I would need to introduce early in the first book and then add some background history in further books as we go. Everybody grows and their life changes daily. So their history isn't all revealed to you the first time that you meet them. And these books will all occur over a period of maybe 4 or 5 days is when the book happens. And then there may be months or years in between stories. So it's really going to try to give you a little bit of idea of what has been happening with him and his background. The newest book I'm working on now, it's almost finished, is even a little further background history on Jack. Introduced some characters that were based partly because of a lot of emails I received from readers asking questions about the book and suggesting things for future books. So I do listen to my readers a lot of times too.
And so what's kind of the reaction that now you've been getting from, you know, from this latest book?
The Coldest Fear, I've had a lot of very good comments about it. Like you said, I think it developed Jack's character a little bit further from the first book. And if you've read the first book, or even if you hadn't, they're kind of standalone, but you can link them in your mind if you would think about it.
Right.
But I've written them deliberately to make them standalone. I don't talk about one book in the other book to the degree that it gives the story away. It's just references to what may have occurred in the past. And a lot of that is left out deliberately then so that you want to read the other book. That is one of the hard things to do, is to try to continue with a character and maybe he's been injured in some way and you don't want to give away completely why he was injured or how, because if you do that, then you ruin the next story.
Well, and that's the one thing that, you know, when you're looking back at, you know, when you wrote The Cruelest Cut, and now you had to go and you had to turn right back around and write the, you know, The Coldest Fear with your character, how was that transition? Because you had to do that one a lot faster than you had to do the other one, because you had a longer time to write The Cruelest Cut, but now all of a sudden you had to turn right back around and write this next one.
Yeah, that's kind of a funny story in a way, because when I finished The Cruelest Cut, I had about 2.5-3 months before I even was supposed to, by contract, start on the next story. So the way I work, I have a very good work ethic. I thought, I'm going to get ahead of the game here and start writing. Well, I had almost 300 pages done in 3 months. And when my editor got a hold of me and said, we're ready for the next book, for the Coldest Fear, for you to go ahead and send us some pages and we'll see what you're working on, I sent it to her and she didn't like it.
Yeah.
So there were so many changes that were suggested to me that I actually scrapped that book, except for Jack, of course, and started over basically with a new book. So I was really kind of under the gun to finish that one in 6 months, which I did, and I just worked steadily at it every day. I write at least 4 to 5 hours every day, 7 days a week.
Right.
So that really gives you a lot of time to come up with the material and go back and correct it and rewrites.
So, and when you're looking forward, and you know, your fans are always talking about, oh, you know, what's coming up in the future, do you have a sense of, you know, are you going to, like you said, you wanted Jack to keep going on further, but are you starting to get the sense of, you know what, maybe there's maybe a character or two that can, you know, that's in the book, so maybe I can spin off or do something else or do another standalone or something. You know, are those thoughts kind of in your mind too?
Oh, yeah. I've got a file on my computer that are just ideas. And some of them may just be 2 or 3 sentences and some may be 100 pages of notes. And I keep all that separate so that my next 4 books are actually planned out almost
wow.
to the of an overview. So I know where the story is going for the next 4 books, but that doesn't mean that something may happen while I'm writing one of them that I say, oh, I've got to do something else here. You know, there's another book that goes in between. And I do have a book that I wrote early on, probably in 2004, 2003, with the same character, but not as the type, the genre book that it is now, it was more of a police procedural and not with all the other trappings. So I've had that book finished for a long time, and I'm thinking eventually to bring it back as the prequel to the series. It's kind of like having one in the bank.
Oh, so that's something that, you know, that's a little bit interesting that you're going to do. So you're kind of going to go back to the beginning, and then you're going to kind of continue it forward.
Right. So the prequel will kind of introduce Jack Murphy from the very beginning, how he meets his partner, and what happens to him in the very beginning that makes him the person that he is. And I had a very good plot for that one. I've just kind of been sitting on it because I had to change it slightly because it wasn't exactly like the other books. So I had to go back and rewrite part of it. But I like the idea of having one in the bank. And then if they ask me for something quick,
yeah,
I have
you got it.
Right.
And, you know, when people go on, they're going to see something else when they're on your site. And we haven't talked about it yet because it's something that was just, you know, totally different from what you were writing here with The Coolest Cut and The Coldest Fear. Again, we're speaking with Rick Reed, author of his latest book, The Coldest Fear, second in his Jack Murphy series. RickReedBooks.com is his website. They're going to see another book called Blood Trail. And you kind of updated that from in June 2011. What exactly, I mean, it's a true crime-ish kind of novel where, you know, you're talking about all the true crime because you've updated things. So how exactly, you know, has this book kind of worked in with you that you wrote with another author at one time?
Yeah, the Blood Trail was really my first attempt at publishing, and that book only came about because I actually caught a serial killer. When I was a detective, I worked all kinds of different crimes, white-collar crimes and juvenile burglaries and all that, but I worked quite a few homicides also. And in this case, with Blood Trail, I was actually working in white-collar crime, what they call Bunko Fraud Unit, and was tracing a guy that was kiting money between banks and writing bad checks. And that was how that case came about. The end of it was that the woman he was writing bad checks on last turned out to be an ex-girlfriend that he had broken in on, confined, tortured her, killed her, and cut her into 10 pieces. And then he fled. And the reason I even got involved was because he was using her checks and credit cards as he fled the scene. So it was kind of a very strange case. It took a twist on him when I caught him in Ohio. Wow. And interviewed him. It went, yeah, that's like a 5.5-hour drive from where I was located. Yeah. But I had put a bulletin out on him, and we caught up with him in Ohio. And I went and interviewed him, and he confessed to that murder first. And we worked on that murder and got the conviction, and then about 2 years later, he confessed to 13 other murders. The twist on him now was that, and the reason that the book was updated, in 2011, I was in New York, actually, for Thriller Fest, when I got a call from a prosecutor in Vandenberg County, where I lived, telling me that they needed to talk to me in another county up north, in Indiana, because Joe had killed his cellmate. My suspect in that case was a guy named Joseph Weldon Brown.
Mm-hmm.
But he eventually strangled his cellmate, just like he'd strangled all these women, and left him hogtied dead on the floor of the cell, called the guard after Joe made coffee first, called the guard and said, "You better come down and get him, he's starting to stink," or something like that.
Wow.
So he's back in isolation again, which is where he should stay. But, you know, what do you do with a guy like that? They gave him another life without parole sentence.
Yeah, he doesn't care. He doesn't care. What is it?
Right. If he kills 20 people, what difference is it to him? So
yeah.
I think the only answer to Joe is probably the death penalty, but the death penalty cost about $1 million, where
yep.
life without yep. parole probably cost him $100,000. So it's hard to say.
You know, and that's one of the things. Now, have you been able to, have you talked with him since this incident happened?
Not since he killed his cellmate. At one point, they were telling me that they would probably need to have me come up there and talk to him. And I was expecting that call, but I pretty much had told the prosecutor where he was being housed that there wasn't really a whole lot I could do. Unless he had more information about other murders, the best I could do was that he liked me, and if they needed him to tell him about this murder, I'd be happy to help out. But, you know, unless he had information on other murders, I didn't know really what purpose I would serve. He's in the cell with his dead cellmate, and nobody else has been in there. There's really not much of a case. You know, he had to have done it. So I couldn't see that they would really need me much for an investigation. I halfway have expected to hear from him, but then I moved from Indiana. I live in California now. So I'm kind of hoping that he doesn't know where I live now. He used to have my home address.
Oh, God, yeah, that's not a good thing. But, hey, you know what?
Yeah.
If you ever want to talk to him, and you know what? I would do a platform, and he can come right on this radio show, and the three of us, and we can sit here, and we'll talk it out. I'm just putting that out there for you, that if you want to do it, we'll talk. I'll put him on the air, and we'll see. Because the one thing that I think a lot of people don't understand, they're like, you know, and it's like, oh, let's kill him. Well, and that's one thing, but like you said, not just the cost of $1 million to be able to have to do that, which a lot of people think it's a lot cheaper to kill somebody than it is to keep them in prison, which is when you read articles, is the biggest myth out there that you can actually read. But
right.
there's things that these criminals have information to just better understand the psyche and the warnings and the signs to be able to see possibly more profiling of when these things happen to be able to catch these, and you don't have as many cold cases of these things that go on.
Right. You want to not shut somebody down where they don't tell you what they really did. If
right.
you're just going for that one particular crime, you may get that, and you'll get nothing surrounding it, which doesn't help you with the next case either when you run into another person. So a lot of it is trying to get into their mind and form type of a relationship with them to where they can talk to you. If they don't feel comfortable telling you the truth, they're not going to.
Yeah, because you know what? They have no reason to. There's nothing for them. You're not going to let them out or get good on good behavior because they told you where five more victims were. So they have nothing
right.
to gain. They have nothing to gain.
Yeah, in Joe's case, he actually felt like he wasn't getting the respect he deserved. And there's a thing called Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's a theory about what makes people who they are and what they need. And I've always used that to try to figure out where my suspect is on that scale. What is it that he needs to make him feel comfortable enough to start sharing with me? And then you work on that and you try to get them to the level that they feel safe enough to sit and talk to you, just like they would to their brother or a friend or themselves. And it's very difficult and time-consuming to do that because you have to listen as much as you talk, and you have to watch what they're doing, and you have to put a lot of faith and trust in them. In this case, when I was with Joe interviewing him, he wasn't handcuffed, and I didn't know he had killed 13 other women, but I kind of suspected that the woman that he had been with, I thought she might be dead. I wasn't sure. But after he started telling me these things and told me about dismembering her, and he actually confessed that he was on his way to kill family members in Ohio when we caught him. And I'm sitting in the garage of the sheriff's department alone with him while he has a cigarette and a cup of coffee and no handcuffs. And he's sitting there telling me about, well, I'm sure glad you caught me when you did, Rick. He says, because I was on my way to my brother's house. I was going to kill him and his wife and his kids.
That just puts like a lump in your throat. Like, Jesus Christ, what is going on with people?
Right. It gives you a chill. But the thing is, as an interviewer in these cases, you're kind of playing a part. And you're not playing the part of a policeman. You're playing the part of somebody they can talk to. So
yeah.
You have to react just like the person they started talking to. You have to keep that role. And so you may have to maintain that for 15 or 20 hours. Whatever persona you took on, that's what you have to stay with.
Boy, that's got to be difficult. Very difficult. But I'm just saying right now, if there's a form that you can use right here on my show, we'd be able to go out. We'll hash this stuff out. You know, we'll talk it out. And you can almost utilize all those things and put it into a fictional setting with your book, which is what gives it believability. And while you're in there, while people are reading The Coldest Fear, to know, just from hearing that story alone, to understand and know that when you write these kinds of things, while people think, oh, you know, this is kind of fiction and kind of way out there, it's not way out there. It's really not. It's a lot closer to home than they think.
Oh, yeah. The things that people could do, you just really can't imagine. If you could even think of it, it can be done, and a lot more. The evil that you see out there on the streets and stuff, it changes you. And I've been accused of being a little bit, not paranoid, but alert. And even though I've been retired about 7 years, I still kind of stay alert to my surroundings. I know they're out there. And you know that violence can happen at the drop of a hat. It doesn't have precursors necessarily. You don't get warnings. It just happens.
Yeah.
So it's better that somebody has their eyes open, right?
Absolutely. You always have to. You should always be alert of your surroundings. I mean, if 9/11 didn't teach us one thing, it better should have teach us to just keep your eyes open in the Oklahoma City bombing. Keep your eyes open. If you see things that are suspicious, don't be afraid to speak up. Don't be afraid to say something and let somebody check it out. I mean, if you're wrong, then, you know, yeah, you might be wrong. But if you're right, you just don't know what you're saving or what you're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
So, another funny thing that I just wanted to add about this Joe Brown case and Blood Trail was that he had beat her up before and was convicted of domestic violence, but his sentence was to go to anger management classes. And he failed to go to the anger management classes, so we had a misdemeanor warrant on him for failure to appear for anger management class, and that was the warrant that we arrested him on in Ohio to hold him, so we could go interview him about this murder.
Wow.
That's kind of a twist.
That's kind of a, I mean, this is one of them little dinky things. It's one of them little things that just come up that, again, you just, it's just kind of mind-boggling if you have to sit and actually think about it. I mean, that just is. So, well, I'll tell you what. Go ahead, Rick.
I was just going to say, the other thing with him, too, was he said, the reason he cut her into pieces, he spread body parts over three surrounding counties, threw away dirt, bloody clothing, and things like that in Vandenberg County. But then he went to three surrounding counties and threw body parts away, and later took us and found all the body parts. I went with him, and we walked through cornfields and high grass and bio-oil tanks and everything else, finding body parts. But he said that when he did it, I asked him why he would cut her up, and he said he'd heard about it in prison when he was in before, because he got a life sentence once before and did 18 years of it. And he said that he heard about it in prison, and I said, but you cut her up. He goes, it's just like cutting up a chicken.
Oh, my God. See, just,
that kind
and
of
that's
stuff
the thing.
In my mind.
Yeah, just no appreciation, I guess, for human, just looking at him like an animal. They're just cutting up chicken.
Yeah, it was like cutting up a chicken.
Man.
I couldn't believe he said that.
Well, Rick, I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing, you know, just those kinds of stories, along with your book here that is out, people, The Coldest Fear, second in the Jack Murphy series. RickReedBooks.com is the website. Find anything you can. Follow Rick on Facebook and all those other fun places. So, Rick, thank you again so much for coming on. Enjoy yourself. Happy Father's Day, and we will see you hopefully coming up here with your third book, and we'll talk about it then and see how things have progressed with good old Jack.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Have a good one, Rick.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. So, again, everybody, that is author Rick Reed with his book here, The Coldest Fear, and RickReedBooks.com is the website. We want to go back, and we want to thank Alan Jacobson with his book, Heart Target. Eric Van Lustbader with his next story, because he's writing the Bourne series, The Bourne Operative, and Blood Trust, which comes out here in paperback. We just had Bruce Hobold on earlier, too, with his book, Lonesome Animals, and now Rick Reed with his book, The Coldest Fear. Again, everybody, I want to remind you that Suspense Magazine is going to be July edition. June edition just came out here about 10 days ago. If you want 4 free issues, all you have to do is email editor@suspensemagazine.com, and we will send it out to you so you can be able to get the inside story in your favorite genre of suspense, mystery, thriller, horror, and see your authors and see the books and keep you updated on things that are going on. We can't hit everything. Just going to let you know. That's why we have Suspense Radio, to kind of bring out more things to you. One thing that we are doing that is very exciting is we've created a series. I'm one of the co-authors along with Donald Allen Kirch, and it's called Green Lake, and it is an original series that is going to be given to you in parts. So it's kind of like we've made it like a TV show where you're going to be reading, and every scene is more is about 2,000 or so words. You can get it for free. You can get it on Smashwords. We publish on the blog site. We put it on Wattpad. We're going to be continuing to keep doing this. You're going to get at least a scene a week. You could get more. You want to check out Facebook, like our Facebook page. We'll update it there. We'll tweet out when we have new things so you can keep track of what's going on in the city of Green Lake. It's a small town, and we hope you enjoy what we're all doing, again, to just try to do something a little bit different than the norm. So it's been a very exciting time. We will be back next weekend. We have an exciting show next weekend that we just happened to be able to put together. We're going to have author James Rollins and David Morrell coming here on the show together back-to-back for an hour episode of Suspense Radio. So check that out next week. Check out suspensemagazine.com. Click on the Suspense Radio button for everything that's going on guest-wise. And we will see you next week again, 10 o'clock Pacific. Archive the show, whatever you want to do, or listen to it. Happy Father's Day, everybody. See you next weekend. Bye-bye.